This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Statesmanship, a word that I learned most recently, dates to the 1970s. So 50 years later, it's good to review that word, its meaning, especially when it comes to the American presidency. And where did it go? It was just here 50 years ago. I welcome Stephen F. Hayward, the Edward Gaylord Distinguished Visiting Professor at Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, writing of statesmanship and other terms at Civitas Outlook, part of the Civitas Institute at the University of Texas. Professor, a very good evening to you. Statesmanship 50 years ago, what was it? It sounds flattering. Good evening to you.
Well, good evening, John. It's really an old term that was used really for centuries, and then it started going out of favor about 50 years ago for a bunch of, I think, bad reasons. But essentially, we usually think of someone as a statesman who stands above the cut of ordinary politicians, right? So we think of Lincoln, George Washington, Churchill, Napoleon, perhaps, although, you know, he has a more mixed reputation. And it always meant someone of extraordinary insight and leadership capabilities. And we quit using the term, both in academic political science and in history and in biography, and even in journalism, for a whole bunch of bad reasons. One is academic political scientists think it's unscientific. They think if you can't measure something quantitatively, it's not meaningful, which I think is dumb. Second, it's kind of inegalitarian. You know, a statesman is somebody we think of as having special excellence as a human being, which I think is also true. And that cuts against the grain of the radical egalitarianism that gnaws away at so many of our institutions these days.
An example, you identify Abraham Lincoln as the beau ideal of a statesman. How so?
Well, actually, that was his phrase for his hero before he was president, who was Henry Clay. And he said, you know, Henry Clay is my beau ideal of a statesman. He took a leading role in all the major issues of our country. And then he does add that, of course, because he took a side in a lot of issues, his record's controversial. And one thing that's, you know, a lot of people who say either hate Ronald Reagan or hate Franklin Roosevelt will say, well, that person's not a statesman because I don't like what they did. And I think that it's a mistake to let partisanship get in the way, or, you know, our own opinions on issues get in the way of our evaluation of individual political figures as people who are capable and who made significant change. So that's why I think you can be a statesman and still be someone maybe you don't like.
I'm drawn to the wit that says a statesman is a politician who's safely dead. Who said that?
Well, that's funny. That was Thomas Reed, who was Speaker of the House more than 100 years ago, a Republican. And supposedly he was never interested in being president. He thought being Speaker of the House was a better job than being president, which shows you how much our whole perception of modern American government has changed.
Now we come to up to date. The presidency as a statesman. I think that we could argue very effectively that Abraham Lincoln was a statesman when it came to maneuvering the Civil War. However, in the 20th century, it's more challenging. Woodrow Wilson was a statesman when he was in Europe, and at home, he was quarrelsome. Does he qualify as a statesman today in memory?
Well, you know, I'm a huge critic of Wilson. I think his legacy for the country has been very bad. That's my opinion, and it's not mine alone. But certainly you have to say, you know, he did some, you know, he changed the presidency, right? He made it a lot bigger than it had been before on purpose. Just to give you one example that was not in my article, it was Wilson who brought back the practice that we're now familiar with of the president giving a State of the Union speech before Congress in person. Almost no presidents did that in the 19th century, and he brought it back. And now it's this big televised spectacle we see every year. And, you know, he brought us what we call Wilsonian internationalism, which, you know, I think both parties kind of adopted over the years. And Trump is trying to break away from that to a certain extent. And, you know, he really believed in expert or, you know, bureaucratic government, to put a maybe a slightly pejorative frame on it. And I think that was a mistake. But certainly he made more lasting changes in America's constitutional order than maybe any other modern president, including even Franklin Roosevelt.
He was a scholar. He worked extremely hard. He'd studied the Congress. He'd studied the presidency since he was a student. So he was conscious of these matters. But I go to his welcoming in Europe when he sailed there for the first round of the negotiation of what became the Versailles Treaty. He was celebrated as a savior. The crowds were enormous, and he hosannas everywhere. Did that influence the understanding of him as a statesman? Is that still persuasive?
Yes, and maybe no. I say yes. I mean, of course, they would greet him as a hero because the belated American entry into the war was thought crucial to ending it, because that war could have gone on for another 2 or 3 years. You know, both sides were planning, you know, war to go into 1919 and beyond. On the other hand, there is a school of thought, and Churchill came to this view later, that if America had stayed out, at some point the Europeans would have had to make a settlement amongst themselves. And, you know, the Versailles Treaty had all kinds of things wrong with it. And, you know, the messiness with the way that ended and the defects of the Versailles Treaty can be said to have contributed to the rise of fascism and Hitler. And so you can never tell a counterfactual, but things might have turned out better if Wilson and the United States had stayed out. But it's certainly understandable why Europeans were relieved at the time to have him there.
It also welcomed the United States to international treaty organizations and obligations. And there was the influence of one particular member of Wilson's administration. That would be the Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Franklin Roosevelt. Yes.
So one way to read your essay is the League of Nations becomes the United Nations, and we're still burdened with the inconsistencies of that internationalism.
That's correct. I mean, you know, the League of Nations, first of all, it should be just said in one sentence that Wilson might have been able to get the League of Nations through the Senate if he hadn't been so stubborn and uncompromising. You know, many Republicans were willing to make a deal with him with some changes, and he was so stubborn he wouldn't do it. That was a mistake on his part. But second, I think even if we had joined the League, it wouldn't have been any more effective in preventing what happened later than the United Nations has been since 1945 and preventing war and conflict. My own opinion on these matters is it is better to have regional alliances like NATO, like some of our alliances with English-speaking countries like Australia, New Zealand, and Britain, than to try and have some global organization, which is always going to end up being, as the United Nations is, very corrupt, very anti-American in a lot of ways, right? And so I think that's another example of Wilsonian idealism not working out, and I don't think it will ever work out.
The connection to Franklin Delano Roosevelt is important and obvious. I want to pause a moment on Woodrow Wilson. He is a progressive president. What does that mean, Steve?
The best way of putting it was he once said that the problem with our Constitution, and remember that Wilson was the first American president to criticize the Constitution. He said it was obsolete and outmoded, but hard to change. And he said our original Constitution is very Newtonian, like, you know, Isaac Newton's equal and opposite reactions affect each other. And he said our Constitution now must be Darwinian. That's the phrase he used. It needs to evolve with the times. And so it's Wilson who gave us the living Constitution doctrine. And of course, as I like to say, the idea of the living Constitution means the written Constitution is dead.
We come to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who repeats the virtues and the limit reaching of Woodrow Wilson. We have internationalism with the United Nations, born in 44-45 in Roosevelt's imagination and then actual. And we also have the challenge to the court in 36-37, which is an attempt to bend the Constitution to programs out of the New Deal. So can we say that though Franklin Roosevelt is celebrated as the president of the 20th century, he was a younger version of Woodrow Wilson?
I think that's fair to say. There's some differences that are interesting between them, but I think you're onto something by mentioning in particular the court packing fight, which all the history books say Roosevelt lost. And I think that's mistaken. I think he, in a certain way, won that fight. And here's what I mean. If you go back and read the speeches he gave attacking the Supreme Court, are really startling to read them today. You know, people are complaining now that, you know, Trump is attacking, you know, Obama judges or the judges who get in his way. It's nothing compared to what Roosevelt said. And I like to say to my liberal friends, if you read, you put Roosevelt's language in Trump's mouth, you would be horrified and alarmed and taking to the streets against it. And that part about Roosevelt has been forgotten and overlooked, I think. And he did intimidate the court, and they capitulated to his agenda.
And now we come to the emendation of Roosevelt, of FDR. He grew the government. And so what we have is momentum here. I'll follow your logic, Professor. We have Wilson's internationalism, which was utopian. We have the League of Nations that was international obligations. We have court bending, challenging by FDR. And then we had the growth of government. That pretty much describes the presidency of, say, Barack Obama and Joe Biden, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think you can say that there have been sort of four leaps forward in, you know, liberal progressive governance in the United States. So Wilson starts it out. We mentioned foreign policy, but he gets the regulatory state launched and then expands under Roosevelt. It expands again under Lyndon Johnson in a big way. And then, you know, once more under Obama and Biden. Just for comparative purposes, I think federal spending as a proportion of GDP under Roosevelt at the height of the New Deal was maybe 14% of GDP. Today, it's more like 23-24%. So our government is twice as large as a proportion of the economy than it was in the New Deal. And it's all been a steady ratchet upward, with once in a while Ronald Reagan comes along and tries to slow it down with some success. But the long term trend is to bigger government and more spending.
I'm speaking to Professor Steve Hayward. We're talking of the presidency. Remember, we started with statesmanship, and now we're going to a larger government. What's the payoff? Well, the payoff is the way to interpret the present administration and the starts and stops of challenges that are in the history books of the 20th century. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.